Today, Mr. Pengelly will speak to us on In the Beginning Was the Spoken Word, or It's All in the Voice.
The poor illiterate miner who never knew the love of God, who never had a chance. It was Wesley who lifted them up and put them on a solid foundation, though they couldn't read nor write. But by simple faith, the common miner found peace with God through Wesley. When Wesley came here, what did he find? Drunkards, reprobates, dinners and wreckers. But it was Wesley who lifted them and raised them. What did the church do? The bishops and some that are in the neighboring neighborhoods, some of our vicars, when you read their history, they were impious men. They turned down the poor miner. They turned down the illiterate. Because why? The church then was for only a chosen few. And it was Wesley, the great sheet anchor of Wesleyanism, who established radicalism and faith and love among the Cornish men. And from Wesley, the great evangelical faith of the Wesleyan movement sprung in America through the Cornish miner, from the copper mines of Calumet to the gold mines of Colorado.
Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, demonstrates and encapsulates what I believe truly constitutes oral history. It is a concept in which the manner of saying can be as important and revealing, if not more so, than just the word content. This, though, is in direct contradiction to the view of many so-called oral historians, and that the end product of oral history should be just a typed transcript. I believe it to be self-evident that a transcript of what you have just heard, an old Cornish miner who came to the United States seeking his fortune in the early years of this century, would not and could not rise from the page in the way that it does but for its oral realization. Indeed, it is my respect for the oral record, including its musical realization, that motivated and largely comprised two of my earlier presentations to ASK, the technical and subjective realization of archival sound at Chapel Hill in 1981, and the castrato, countertenor, and male alto voices at Bowling Green in 1984. In both these presentations, I was seeking to prove the record, no pun intended, and to substantiate that record without recourse to dehumanization by straight or flat dubbing, something I still await etymological clarification of from those who advocate such an unproved philosophy. In the case of the Moresky Sistine Chapel castrato recordings, those who were present at last year's New York ASK conference may remember that by the use of genuine reverberation, and I stress genuine reverberation, such as was the natural habitat of Moresky in St. Peter's in Rome, I was able, in some measure, to equate the well-informed, contemporary, and fulsome praise of Moresky, so hard to understand today, with the oral record, so that the apparent dichotomy between the two accounts is at least diminished. Staying in an Italian context, can I offer a personal example to illustrate that indeed there is a very great deal, if not all, in the voice. When I visited Puccini's villa in Torre del Lago, there were mementos of the great composer everywhere about, his manuscripts, his piano, his hunting guns, and so on, but no record of how the great man expressed himself in the spoken form. I remedied this by supplying a dub from Cylinder of both Puccini and his wife, and this is now one of the memorabilia at the villa. Much, of course, has been written about the unhappy relationship between Puccini and his wife, Elvira. but only when I played the recording of both of them to Italians did the reason for their basic incompatibility become apparent. As you'll hear now, the fine and dignified patrician Italian of Puccini contrasts markedly with the harsh and shrewish regional accent of Elvira.
Ringrazio con tutto cuore l'egregio signor Biafora per le gentili parole pronunziate. Sono veramente grato al gran pubblico di New York per le accoglienze tanto entusiastiche che ha fatto alle mie opere. Accetto l'augurio del buon viaggio e finisco gridando America forever!
Da parte mia, chiesa, per gli onori tributati a mio marito, lascio un saluto ed un caldo ringraziamento a tutti e specialmente alle gentili signore americane che furono tanto contenti verso di noi. E tu la
And the comment of Italians on hearing that recording, ah, capito, capito, now we understand. In similar fashion, it was the oral record that confirmed for me and a large gathering of the Cornwall Family History Society meeting in the Prince of Wales' own duchy that Juan Ricardo José of Silver Threads Among the Gold fame was in fact the more mundane Dickie Jose from Lanner in Cornwall, England. Here are just two gobbets, both repeated to make the point that the words heart and choir could only have been pronounced in the way they are by a true Cornishman and not a latter-day conquistador. I understand that certain skilled dialecticians can sometimes similarly identify the residents of Brooklyn by their accents. But now, Dickie Jose from Lanner in Cornwall. Well, I hope that goes some way to prove that written and printed words, and I of course include musical notation, are merely the dry bones of expression. And only when life is breathed into them by human agency do those symbols convey their full and proper import. Surely it is this special element in the oral record that was the basic motivation that gave birth to ASK. Whether that oral record be John F. Kennedy's Ich bin ein Berliner or Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream. And because for many years I was a BBC InVision self-opt television announcer, I can't resist a trail at this point and to encourage you to stay, that at the conclusion of this presentation, I shall be playing a recording, a first time hearing in this Western Hemisphere of The King of Kings. So if Ed Murrow didn't hear it then, you can hear it now. And deduce what you will from the sound of a voice. The examples I've cited of Kennedy and King are, of course, oral history in a noble manifestation. At other times and in another context, the oral record can be less than noble. Here I tread warily, out of respect both for the Monroe Doctrine and for a country that has offered me great hospitality and kindness. I must admit, however, that there is a certain irony that I should be giving this paper in this city above all others. Suffice to say that I understand some actuality tapes made not a million miles from here and perhaps best referred to as aqua porta or hydrophily reveal a candor and sometimes even an opposite meaning to the mere literal and pedantic word expression on the printed page. How do you express irony in the written word? Now, lest it should be thought that I am claiming a chauvinistic moral superiority on behalf of my own country, something similar to aqua porta arose out of the recent conflict between Britain and Argentina. A radio ham in the Falklands unwittingly recorded conversations between our Prime Minister's press secretary, the assistant director of the BBC, the head of news of the British Commercial Television Network, and a phone call into number 10 Downing Street, the equivalent of your White House. The recordings were subsequently broadcast on British Commercial Television, and more recently on BBC Television, accompanied by captions to facilitate comprehension because of the poor speech quality. The acerbity, frankness, and candor of expression, including the direct threat in the recordings, was raised in our House of Commons, the equivalent of your Congress. Of the recordings, it was said by a member of the House of Commons, and I quote from Hansard, the official printed record of the proceedings of the House, "To make a judgment, one has to hear the conversation to get the flavor of it." End of quote. Here now is just some of that flavor in its actuality form, bristling with invective and displaying a wide dynamic range of passion that no writer, no matter how skilled, could hope to translate into mute words on a page. If the speech quality is poor in the extreme, then blame the Falklands radio ham, not me. In the context of this presentation, though, it is the flavor I would ask you to note. More than that, I have copies of Hansard with me available for those who would like them, including the denial that no exact record existed when such record was in fact available in the library of the House of Commons.
"We have the dog in the manger attitude. More actually from the BBC, and I am deeply hurt. And you've got to get it into your mind, and the media has got to get it into its mind, that we don't operate for your convenience, we operate for the security of the Prime Minister. And the sooner you get that in your mind, the better. I'm fed up with it. I had it in Northern Ireland. What else can I do? What else is it possible to do? You ask for everything, and you can't have that. I didn't even talk to my wife.
You are threatening me, quite obviously. You are making conditions
and threats. I'm sure the Prime Minister, if I had to tell her what is going on, would scarcely credit it. I have kept this away from her.
David,
this is Bernard Ingham in Fort Stanley. I have told the BBC that they have behaved childishly and stupidly. They have deeply hurt me. However, as a result of making a large number of threats, which they deeply resent and I greatly regret having to make, being forced to make them, we have, to the best of my knowledge, got it sorted out.
Well, that recording and others like it demonstrates the power of the spoken word to express the truth in a way that the word on the page never can. The great German Iron Chancellor Bismarck was perhaps the first to recognize the power of recordings as an agency for truth when he declared that the phonograph was, and I quote, "a dangerous thing for diplomats as they would be forced to tell the truth," end of quote. What the man or woman said in an actuality situation, and I stress actuality situation, must always be nearer the truth than any written account that has inevitably been influenced by the subjectivity of the writer. Again, I stress, not necessarily in word content, but because of the inability of word symbols to express themselves with the finesse of speech, since on occasion, words of the same spelling can have two totally different meanings. Words like Polish and polish, recreation and recreation, and something I picked up here earlier this week, bass and bass, and Z and Z. Now, this is not to decry the old age Gutenberg method of communication, but rather to establish the claim of the recorded spoken word as an adjunct and correction to it. Refreshingly, the law, forever conscious of the precision of words, has now in Britain certainly accepted that in using tape recordings in court, and I quote, it is acting on real evidence if it treats the intonation of the words as relevant, end of quote. As in other spheres, though, many lawyers, as distinct from the law, eschew the tape-recorded actuality of what the man said because of their vested interest in both disputing and throwing doubt on what the man or woman did in fact say. And if the law in general is taking cognizance of the value of actuality recordings and all the finesse of meaning it is capable of, this is a virtue not universally subscribed to. Surprisingly, the BBC, that uses both audio and visual recordings to prove the veracity of matters external to itself, prohibits the use of recordings in matters concerning its own affairs. The British Social Service Organization, likewise, refuses to accede to requests to make recordings to establish the undoubted truth of matters. And for both organizations, the written and necessarily subjective record is the only one allowed. An area where oral historians have long been active with great success and without recourse to the written transcript is in the collection of dialects. Here now is a short piece I recorded as a vox pop at the Royal Cornwall Showground, what I think you would call a state fair. I must ashamedly admit that I exhibit the worst form of snobbism in using the dialect and language of the people I talk to. As a European, I'm fascinated by the many accents of the United States, but happily, those accents do not divide your country socially as they do mine. Those you hear now include what I believe you call dear old boys. There's a bishop, two noble lords, assorted groundlings, and finally, a Cornish member of parliament.
Excuse me, sir, where'd you come from?
Oh, I live at Padstow.
What do you think of it here today?
Oh, beautiful. Couldn't be better.
What makes you want to come to a show like this?
I come to meet old friends. I'm not connected in any way with farming. I don't know one end of an animal from another. But I come here to meet old friends who I see once in 12 months.
So the showground here is just a meeting place?
I come three days. And I like all the exhibitions that are here. I'm not very interested in animals, but I like all the exhibitions in the tents.
And a bit of a gossip?
Well, maybe so. Maybe so.
What's the gossip going around here today, then?
Well, I haven't heard very much. I've just seen the Bishop of Truro go through here, but he didn't speak to me.
Excuse me, Bishop?
Well, it's marvellous, as always. I love coming here, and it's a great occasion for me. What I like doing more than anything else is just simply walking down, meeting the people, and what always encourages me is the fact that I find there are so many people I know in the parishes whom I actually meet here again in the show.
So it's a congregation for
in a way? It is in many ways for me, just that.
A lovely atmosphere here.
Oh, it is lovely. Yes, it is lovely. Real handsome.
What do you think of the show, then?
I think it's proper. I don't know when I've seen a better show, mine.
Tidn't too hot, is it?
No, the weather is as good as ever it could be. It tidn't too hot, you haven't got to take your coat off, and you haven't got to wear boots, which is a grand thing, mine.
A lovely lot of Cornish people here.
Lovely lot. Well, you'll generally find it in Cornwall, mine.
But not too many visitors, God bless them, mind you.
One or two English people down, but I don't think they'll stop them long.
But I hear they ain't bringing much money with them.
Very, very short of cash. Never seen that people so short of cash in my life.
So that's your message from the Weybridge show, is it?
My message from the Weybridge show, if you're coming down here, bring some cash.
There's a lot of the Cornish gentry and aristocracy here.
Oh, yes, quite a lot of them, quite a lot of them. Lord Falmouth and Sir John Moseris and Oban, all those boys, you know, there's...
Well, Mr. President, what sort of show?
It's been an absolutely marvellous day. Lots of people here, lots of fun.
A success financially, do you think?
I'm told it has been. We've made a lot of new members this year.
Excuse me, sir, your name?
Lord Morley.
What do you think of the show, sir?
I think, as always, it's a super show, and I reckon it's the best show in England, and I go to quite a lot.
Better than the Devon one?
I must be very careful.
That's a very good show, too. They're both very good shows.
Excuse me, sir, your name is?
My name's David Penelligan.
You're a local man, are you?
That's right, yes, local. Chasewater lad, I think, is my description, yes.
What do you think of it here today, then?
Oh, proper job, no doubt about that.
Well, that, of course, was a direct bit of reportage, not without technical faults, but hopefully of some interest to the social historian of the future. My preference is ideally for oral history to be of such significance as to carry itself without the necessity of an interlocutor, and certainly not an uninvolved narrator. Here's a short piece I recorded about the 60th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme in the First World War, in which 20,000 British soldiers were killed on the very first day of the battle.
Then we all got ready, and the officer in charge told us there that all you had to do, the Germans waiting over there to put their hands, all you had to do was bring them in. But that was untrue. We never gained an inch. Well, we got at the first of the front line trench there, and there was the men all piled up there, wounded and dead, and over the no man's land, they was hanging on the barbed wire.
If you want the old battalion, I know where they are. They're hanging on the old barbed wire. I saw them hanging on the old barbed wire. I saw them hanging on the old barbed wire.
Well, you just had to go forward, that was all. You know, you kept as low as you could. But I was no braver than anybody else. Bravery, I don't know about bravery. You just had to go, that was it.
But their first knowledge of the battle was the fact that Germans shouted over to them, when you're going to attack, we're expecting you. They knew very well indeed, and that's one of the reasons why the casualties were so terrific. But they put up boards with signs on, when you're going to attack, we're expecting you.
The Germans was the same as we, sir. Of course they was. They was afraid and they was brave. The same as we, he was there for what he had to do, and that was that.
Good as we was. Well, you nipped over the top and went as fast as you could go and dropped down in each other. If Jerry was gone, he was gone. If he wasn't, well, you had to frighten out from where he was.
We had a terrible time, and the casualties there was enormous. As you see, it's 8,900 of the Devons that started in the battle, and was a matter of about, well, less than 200 that was all right when the battle finished. And of course, a lot of them could be saved, but the stretcher bearers couldn't come up to take them away because the shelling and that was so bad.
Almost my first job was to go out and bury a man with a corporal and a man in the dark. We go out to find this body and to bury him. But he had no papers. He was a Gordon Highlander. And then I wondered what I had to do with these two men in the dark. And not having taken a service or anything in my life before, suddenly said the Lord's Prayer, which we all joined in, then rushed back in the trenches again because there was shelling, and often wondered who that man was.
Incidentally, if you heard a clicking in the first of those pieces, it was an old boy with a loose denture. Clocks can be removed, not teeth. Of course, for some subjects, the involvement of an interviewer is essential. And here are some extracts from a piece I did with a teenage aristocratic English schoolgirl who had an affair with the great Marconi, the man credited with inventing the wireless. Of interest, I think, not only for the content, but for the accent of a high-born English lady of the 1920s, and at the moment, the Mountbatten referred to is Lord Mountbatten, the Queen's uncle.
He was a very shy man. And then he took a great fancy to me, and I didn't know that it was the fancy that he wanted to marry me or that he was in love with me. I had no idea, because he never made any physical approach to me. I mean, he never was messing about with me. But he was really a godsend, because, you see, I was a stranger. I was an only child. And this wonderful thing came into my life, and he used to ask me what I wanted, and he just gave it to me. He gave me everything.
What, for instance?
Books, jewelry, everything that I wanted, he bought me. Because, you see, I was still at school. And when I went back to school, he came and anchored the yacht at Bournemouth. And Dickie Mountbatten was on the yacht. And we got blown out. I mean, he couldn't come back with Catherine Morrison Bell, luckily, who was head girl. And the two of us were on the yacht, and we couldn't come back that night to my boarding school.
And so I was so frightened, I couldn't go back by myself. I said, oh, Billy, you must come and explain to the headmistress. And Dickie Mountbatten came too, and they both came and explained that we had really been blown out and that we couldn't come back.
When did you first become aware that Marconi was in love with you?
Well, I suppose when I was privately presented to the Queen of Italy, who was also a friend of my mother's, through the Red Cross in the First Great War, and she talked to me afterwards, after I'd been presented. It was rather cosy and friendly, and she talked to me as if I was his fiancée. So I explained that I wasn't. And she looked deeply shocked. You see, the Queen really assumed that we were engaged.
Because you were on
yes,
his
so
yacht?
Yes, I went straight to him, because I always told him everything, and I said, Billy.
What did you call him?
Billy.
Why Billy?
Everybody who knew him very well called him Billy.
Because Guglielmo means William.
He always signed Billy on all photographs and things. I said, Billy, the Queen thinks we're engaged. And he said, that's what I want to be. And I said, oh, I don't know about that. And you know, then I rather forgot about it.
Fine. I gather we're running out of time. I was going to play you a bit about a man who knew Queen Victoria and Drake's drum, but we'll go to the last band, if we may, Richard. What should happen? You should have heard a man talking about Queen Victoria, and then a drum roll, actual Drake's drum, being played. And I go on to say, and that drum roll, played on the actual drum carried by Sir Francis Drake on his circumnavigation of the globe 400 years ago, heralds the voice of the King of Kings. In February of this year, I went to Windsor Castle, one of the residences of our Queen, where, in the archives, I was permitted to work on the 1899 cylinder recording made by the Emperor Menelik of Abyssinia in response to a similar recording sent to him by Queen Victoria the previous year. The green cylinder box, wrapped in plush red velvet, had inscribed on the lid, "The Emperor Menelik, King of Kings." I was at once reminded of Shelley's poem, Ozymandias, and the words, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." And despair I did when I saw the barely discernible groove carrying even less discernible evidence of modulation. Nevertheless, from oral transcriptions made of the Menelik cylinder, it has been possible to establish the Emperor's cultivated manner of speech, not showing any significant variation from that of a modern Amharic speaker of comparable background, and so establish something of the character of a pre-1900 major African ruler. I leave you now with just one word from my transcription, repeated several times over to achieve some sort of continuity. And I like to think, though, that this one word is a universal cry from those who wish and would be better remembered, not just from the written record of what they said, but from the way they said it.
Photograph, 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 photograph.
Thank you. And thank you to Richard. Thank you, Richard.